Welcome again. Tonight, we finish the 16th chapter, The Integral Knowledge and the Aim of Life, Four Theories of Existence. And to this point, he has described the supracosmic, the terrestrial, and the supraterrestrial perspectives, and demonstrated why each of them taken separately is wanting, and has suggested that there is a grander synthesis, a union which will bring them all together into a fused whole. And so in these last pages of the chapter, he'll present that. It is, of course, his view, his perspective. We'll come to it again later in the evening, but before it eludes us, the music that you just listened to was called Promise of the 24th, because in India, at this moment, it is the 24th of April, the day when the mother returned to the side of Sri Aurobindo. The idea that it is the promise of the 24th tells all. We'll come back to it. For the moment, let's go forward with this next paragraph. That equation can only be found if we recognize the purport of our whole complex human nature in its right place in the cosmic movement. What is needed is to give its full, legitimate value to each part of our composite being and many-sided aspiration, and find out the key of their unity as well as their difference. The finding must be by a synthesis or an integration, and since development is clearly the law of the human soul, it is most likely to be discovered by an evolutionary synthesis. Synthesis, again, is pulling separate parts into a whole, bringing them into a kind of fusion. If it's an evolutionary synthesis, it means that this occurs over a period of time, and as it evolves, manifests hidden richnesses, not evident to the first view. He continues, a synthesis of this kind was attempted in the ancient Indian culture. It accepted four legitimate motives of human living: man's vital interests and needs, his desires, his ethical and religious aspiration, his ultimate spiritual aim and destiny. In other words, the claims of his vital, physical, and emotional being, the claims of his ethical and religious being, governed by a knowledge of the law of God and nature and man, and the claims of his spiritual longing for the beyond, for which he seeks satisfaction by an ultimate release from an ignorant, mundane existence. So could be successive, could be one displacing the other as time advances for the growth of the human spirit. And the growth in an individual's life. It provided, he writes, for a period of education and preparation based on this idea of life, a period of normal living to satisfy human desires and interests under the moderating rule of the ethical and religious part in us, a period of withdrawal and spiritual preparation, and a last period of renunciation of life and release into the spirit. Evidently, if applied as a universal rule, this prescribed norm, this delineation of the curve of our journey, would miss the fact that it is impossible for all to trace out the whole circle of development in a single short lifetime. But It was modified by the theory of a complete evolution pursued through a long succession of rebirths before one could be fit for a spiritual liberation. So these four stages of life, which began when you were a student, following the path to God, Brahmacharya, and then continuing into the grasping of life, pursuing those things, you know, as a grihastha, and then later, sort of in semi-retirement, ensconced in nature, as vanaprastha, you prepare yourself for the ultimate quest, looking for the renunciation of all as you seek full liberation and immersion in the divine. Kama, artha, etc., etc., all reconciled within the largest scope of development. This synthesis, he says, with its spiritual insight, largeness of view, symmetry, completeness, did much to raise the tone of human life, but eventually it collapsed. Its place was occupied by an exaggeration of the impulse of renunciation, which destroyed the symmetry of the system and cut it into two movements of life in opposition to each other. The normal life of interests and desires with an ethical and religious coloring, and the abnormal or supernormal inner life founded on renunciation. So if the idea was that it would take you a long time, a stadia of lives, as he writes elsewhere, to achieve this kind of consummation of spiritual consciousness, still, there is embedded in the system this opposition between living life to its fullest and pulling away from life to gain access to this greater spiritual consciousness. It is a limitation of the system. Sri Aurobindo is clear about that. As warmly as he embraces the Vedantic tradition founded on Veda, still he sees this limitation in it. The old synthesis, in fact, contained in itself the seed of this exaggeration and could not but lapse into it. For if we regard the escape from life as our desirable end, if we omit to hold up any high offer of life fulfillment, if life has not a divine significance in it, the impatience of the human intellect and will must end by driving at a shortcut and getting rid as much as possible of any more tedious and dilatory processes. If it cannot do that, or if it is incapable of following the shortcut, it is left with the ego and its satisfactions, but with nothing greater to be achieved here. Life is split into the spiritual and the mundane, and there can only be an abrupt transition, not a harmony or reconciliation of these parts of our nature. You know he won't rest with that. A spiritual evolution, an unfolding here of the being within. He draws our attention to the fact that the great being, the transcendent, the unknowable who becomes the positive Sat, is ensconced within us, an unfolding here of the being within from birth to birth. It is that same supreme being which resides in us as we advance on this long evolutionary journey to synthesize all the various perspectives available in the world, to consummate them in the disclosure of our own spiritual truth. A spiritual evolution, an unfolding here of the being within from birth to birth, of which man becomes the central instrument and human life at its highest offers the critical turning point, is the link needed for the reconciliation of life and spirit. For it allows us to take into account the total nature of man and to recognize the legitimate place of his triple attraction to earth, to heaven, and to the supreme reality. But a complete solution of its oppositions can be arrived at only on this basis, that the lower consciousness of mind, life, and body cannot arrive at its full meaning until it is taken up, restated, transformed by the light and power and joy of the higher spiritual consciousness, while the higher too does not stand in its full right relation to the lower by mere rejection, but by this assumption and domination. This taking up of its unfulfilled values, this restatement and transformation, a spiritualizing and supramentalizing of the mental, vital, and physical nature. So necessary for the whole consummation is the full disclosure of all that resides within us, secretly even the supramental, which is present, must come, and then spirit must fulfill matter in this grand collocation of all parts of the being. The terrestrial ideal, which has been so powerful in the modern mind, restored man and his life on earth and the collective hope of the race to a prominent position and created an insistent demand for a solution. This is the good it has accomplished. But by overdoing and exclusiveness, it unduly limited man's scope. It ignored that which is the highest and in the end the largest thing in him, and by this limitation it missed the full pursuit of its own object. If mind were the highest thing in man and nature, then indeed this frustration might not result. Still, the limitation of scope would be there, a narrow possibility, a circumscribed prospect. But if mind is only a partial unfolding of consciousness, and there are powers beyond of which nature and our race is capable, then not only does our hope upon earth, let alone what is beyond it, depend upon their development, but this becomes the one proper road of our evolution. Mind and life themselves cannot grow into their fullness except by the opening up of the larger and greater consciousness to which mind only approaches. Such a larger and greater consciousness is the spiritual, for the spiritual consciousness is not only higher than the rest, but more embracing. Universal as well as transcendent, it can take up mind and life into its light and give them the true and utmost realization of all for which they are seeking. For it has a greater instrumentality of knowledge, a fountain of deeper power and will, an unlimited reach and intensity of love and joy and beauty. These are the things for which our mind, life, and body are seeking: knowledge, power, and joy. And to reject that by which all these arrive at their utmost plenitude is to shut them out from their own highest consummation. An opposite exaggeration, demanding only some colorless purity of spiritual existence, nullifies the creative action of the spirit and excludes from us all that the divine manifests in its being. It leaves room only for an evolution without sense or fulfillment, for a cutting off of all that has been evolved is the sole culmination. It turns the process of our being into the meaningless curve of a plunge into ignorance and return out of it, or erects a wheel of cosmic becoming with only an escape issue. The intermediary, the supra-terrestrial aspiration, cuts short the fulfillment of the being above by not proceeding to its highest realization of oneness, and diminishes it below by not allowing a proper amplitude of sense to its presence in the material universe and its acceptance of life in an earthly body. So he's at pains to describe the limitations of the terrestrial view of things, but also finds that this absorption into the supracosmic makes the universal manifestation absent of meaning. And if we want to hie away simply to the heavens above, the supraterrestrial view, well, we don't fulfill ourselves either in the supreme oneness of what is beyond, what is supracosmic, nor do we fulfill ourselves here upon earth. So all three have failed at this point. A large relation of unity and integration restores the balance, illumines the whole truth of being, and links together the steps of nature. In this integration, the supracosmic reality stands as the supreme truth of being. To realize it is the highest reach of our consciousness. But it is this highest reality which is also the cosmic being, the cosmic consciousness, the cosmic will and life. It has put these things forth, not outside itself, but in its own being, not as an opposite principle, but as its own self-unfolding and self-expression. This unknowable, this sat, this sheer existence, manifests the cosmos within itself, in all its vastness, however illimitable it seems to be. It resides securely and only within this sheer existence. That existence is all there is. The cosmic manifestation is an episode, a phenomenon inside it. Cosmic being is not a meaningless freak or fantasy or a chance error. There is a divine significance and truth in it. The manifold self-expression of the Spirit is its high sense. The divine itself is the key of its enigma. So if there's a secreted truth inside the universe, it is cognate with that being. A perfect self-expression of the Spirit is the object of our terrestrial existence. So, our world, the cosmos, is here for the fulfillment, for the manifestation, for the revelation of its inhaled spiritual truth. This cannot be achieved if we have not grown conscious of the supreme reality. For it is only by the touch of the Absolute that we can arrive at our own Absolute. That justifies the spiritual impulse behind the sannyasi who wants to renounce all so that he can achieve that liberation, that moksha. That is a legitimate movement of the Spirit, but the cancellation of the world is not legitimate. And he continues, but neither can it be done to the exclusion of the cosmic reality. We must become universal, for without an opening into universality, the individual remains incomplete. He suggested that a paragraph or two ago. It is the individual that links the universe back to the transcendent. He's just described the reality of the transcendent and of the universe, and now here comes the justification for individuality. We must become universal. The individual must be cosmic in scope. The individual, separating himself from the all to reach the highest, loses himself in the supreme heights. including in himself the cosmic consciousness. He recovers his wholeness of self and still keeps his supreme gain of transcendence. He fulfills it and himself in the cosmic completeness. A realized unity of the transcendent, the universal, and the individual is an indispensable condition for the fullness of the self-expressing spirit. For the universe is the field of its totality of self-expression, while it is through the individual that its evolutionary self-unfolding here comes to its acme. So if the universe is to evolve, it is done through the upward arc of the individual evolution. But this supposes not only a real being of the individual, but the revelation of our secret eternal oneness with the Supreme and with all cosmic existence. In his self-integration, the soul of the individual must awake to universality and to transcendence. All three are terms of that. The individual is real. The cosmos is real, drawing their reality from the transcendent, of which they are manifestations, large, macrocosmic, and small, microcosmic. In his self-integration, and what is the means of this self-integration? The integral yoga. The supra-terrestrial existence is also a truth of being. For the material is not the only plane of our existence. Other planes of consciousness there are to which we can attain and which have already their hidden links with us. Not to reach up to whatever greater regions of the soul are open to us, not to have the experience of them, not to know and manifest their law in ourselves, is to fall short of the height and fullness of our being. So just as that impulse to the supracosmic is legitimate, so is our impulse to discover these supraphysical planes of being. We must know intimately and in all their powers and manifestations what they are and integrate those into our larger selves as well. But, he writes, worlds of a higher consciousness are not the only possible scene and habitation of the perfected soul, nor can we find in any unchanging typal world the final or total sense of the spirit's self-expression in the cosmos. The material world, this earth, this human life, are a part of the spirit's self-expression and have their divine possibility. That possibility is evolutionary, and it contains the possibilities of all the other worlds in it, unrealized, but realizable. So the worlds that we discover above us, above our physical lives, which are, as we say, supraphysical, above the physical, are not evolutionary. They are typal. They exist at that level. They are limited to that plane of being. If they are to be fulfilled in all their potentiality, they too must emerge in full flower from matter. And that is what we are evolving here. Earth life is not a lapse into the mire of something undivine, vain, and miserable, offered by some power to itself as a spectacle or to the embodied soul as a thing to be suffered and then cast away from it. It is the scene of the evolutionary unfolding of the being, which moves towards the revelation of a supreme spiritual light and power and joy and oneness, but includes in it also the manifold diversity of the self-achieving spirit. There is an all-seeing purpose in the terrestrial creation, A divine plan is working itself out through its contradictions and perplexities, which are a sign of the many-sided achievement towards which are being led the soul's growth and the endeavor of nature. All these collisions of force and consciousness are deeply meaningful, and they signal an eventual harmonization which is not apparent to our limited view. It is true that the soul can ascend into worlds of a greater consciousness beyond the earth, but it is also true that the power of these worlds, the power of a greater consciousness, has to develop itself here. The embodiment of the soul is the means for that embodiment. All the higher powers of consciousness exist because they are powers of the Supreme Reality. Our terrestrial being has also the same truth. It is a becoming of the one reality which has to embody in itself these greater powers. Its present appearance is a veiled and partial figure. And to limit ourselves to that first figure, to the present formula of an imperfect humanity, is to exclude our divine potentialities. We have to bring a wider meaning into our human life and manifest in it the much more that we secretly are. Our mortality is only justified in the light of our immortality. Our earth can know and be all itself only by opening to the heavens. The individual can see himself aright and use his world divinely only when he has entered into greater planes of being and seen the light of the Supreme and lived in the being and power of the divine and eternal. An integration of this kind would not be possible if a spiritual evolution were not the sense of our birth and terrestrial existence. The evolution of mind, life, and spirit and matter is the sign that this integration, this completed manifestation of a secret self contained in it, is its significance. A complete involution of all that the spirit is and its evolutionary self-unfolding are the double term of our material existence. There is a possibility of self-expression by an always unveiled luminous development of the being. A possibility also of various expression in perfect types fixed and complete in their own nature. That is the principle of becoming in the higher worlds. They are typal and not evolutionary in their life principle. They exist, each in its own perfection, but within the limits of a stationary world formula. A deployment which takes the form and goes through the progression of a self-veiling and an adventure of self-recovery. That is the principle of becoming in this universe of which an involution of consciousness and concealment of the spirit in matter is the first appearance. Just to pause for a moment, to look at Sri Aurobindo's view of this absolute transcendence, which pours itself through involution into a dark inconscience which seems to deny its own light, but along the way has studded all of these planes of being, from Sat-Chit-Ananda through the supramental vast world of light, that impressing itself into the light of mind, mind into the power of life, life into the concretization of matter, etc., down into the unconscious. All of this is part of an evolutionary chain to Sri Aurobindo. The idea that there are worlds upon worlds of being, a great chain of being, is not unknown to theology, is not unknown to philosophy, is not unknown to the experience of the human psyche throughout the history of humanity. But this idea of the earth being an evolutionary scene in which all of these planes of being can participate by dint of their involution and then their reemergence in this uncoiling of evolution is unique to Sri Aurobindo. And the individual is key to it all. The individual is what connects the power of that emerging spirit coming out of matter with the absolute above. To connect them all is his fundamental, unavoidable mission. I say he, but I mean the soul, the spirit in the individual. So this takes Sri Aurobindo's view of the worlds beyond what we see in all the theistic religions, beyond what we see in Buddhism, beyond what we see even in ancient Indian thought. All is connected back to this principal urge which is expressed irrepressibly in that which lies within our hearts. And now for the last paragraph of the chapter. An involution of spirit in the inconscience is the beginning. An evolution in the ignorance, with its play of the possibilities of a partial developing knowledge, is the middle and the cause of the anomalies of our present nature. Our imperfection is the sign of a transitional state, a growth not yet completed, an effort that is finding its way. A consummation and a deployment of the spirit's self-knowledge and the self-power of its divine being and consciousness is the culmination. These are the three stages of this cycle of the spirit's progressive self-expression in life. The two stages that have already their place seem at first sight to deny the possibility of the later consummating stage of the cycle, but logically, they imply its emergence. For if the inconscience has evolved consciousness, the partial consciousness already reached must surely evolve into complete consciousness. It is a perfected and divinized life for which the earth nature is seeking, and this seeking is a sign of the divine will in nature. Other seekings also there are, and these too find their means of self-fulfillment. A withdrawal into the supreme peace or ecstasy, a withdrawal into the bliss of the divine presence are open to the soul in earth existence, for the infinite in its manifestation has many possibilities and is not confined by its formulations. But neither of these withdrawals can be the fundamental intention in the becoming itself here. For then, an evolutionary progression would not have been undertaken. Such a progression here can only have for its aim a self-fulfillment here. A progressive manifestation of this kind can only have for its soul of significance the revelation of being and a perfect becoming. It requires practical application. to make it so. This date, the 24th of April, that is just before us here in America, and already there in Pondicherry, marks the return of the mother to Sri Aurobindo. They worked together from that date for 30 years. She remembered years later having gone to see him again in the afternoon after having arrived there, feeling the force of the impact of his being a full 2 nautical miles away from Pondicherry, that as they stood side by side and she looked out with him towards the Bay of Bengal, they both felt the time has come. At that moment, his great illuminated consciousness joined the irresistible empowerment of her being, a force in action, the very spirit of progress, to bring the metaphysic of the life divine towards manifestation upon earth. If this date, the 24th of April, signifies anything, it is that now the hour has come. Let us manifest it. We read, we study, we meditate, we glimpse, we experience, we realize. But until we transform, until we live from inside, from the soul, rather than from outside, in the ego, we have not achieved, nor have we achieved collectively what is possible. What we might do with our own perfection has a limited sphere of impact. What we might do if we collectivized the spiritual consciousness would be a manifestation that we live not only in our individual psychic beings, but in a sense in the larger reality around. Because if we truly live in universality, if we have truly stepped beyond the province of the individual and recovered our oneness with the all around, then the very sign of that will be a community where one sees the all, where all sees the one, where there is balance and interchange and a grand harmony. So, much of our work remains before us, even given the much that we have already evolved into. Fortunately, nobody ever feels fatigue for long. If you practice this yoga sincerely, the mother's energy flows into you and lifts you up and carries you. So, joy, laughter ever on the face, a fire ever in the heart, and the path revealing itself before us. This is a passage from Savitri. I think I would like to read from Book 4, The Book of Birth and Quest, Canto 1, The Birth and Childhood of the Flame. Because yes, I want to read about her. In this high signal moment of the gods, answering Earth's yearning and her cry for bliss, a greatness from our other countries came. A silence in the noise of earthly things immutably revealed the secret word. A mightier influx filled the oblivious clay. A lamp was lit, a sacred image made. A mediating ray had touched the earth, bridging the gulf between man's mind and God's. Its brightness linked our transience to the unknown. A spirit of its celestial source aware, translating heaven into a human shape, descended into earth's imperfect mold, and wept not fallen to mortality, but looked on all with large and tranquil eyes. One had returned from the transcendent plains and bore anew the load of mortal breath, who had striven of old with our darkness and our pain. She took again her divine unfinished task. Survivor of death and the aeonic years, once more with her fathomless heart she fronted time. Again there was renewed, again revealed, the ancient closeness by earth vision veiled, the secret contact broken off in time, a consanguinity of earth and heaven between the human portion toiling here and an as yet unborn and limitless force. Again the mystic deep attempt began, the daring wager of the cosmic game. For since upon this blind and whirling globe, earth plasm first quivered with the illumining mind, and life invaded the material sheath, afflicting in conscience with the need to feel, since in infinity's silence woke a word, a mother wisdom works in nature's breast to pour delight on the heart of toil and want and press perfection on life's stumbling powers, impose heaven's sentience on the obscure abyss and make dumb matter conscious of its God. Although our fallen minds forget to climb, although our human stuff resists or breaks, she keeps her will that hopes to divinize clay. Failure cannot repress, defeat o'erthrow. Time cannot weary her, nor the void subdue. The ages have not made her passion less. No victory she admits of death or fate. Always she drives the soul to new attempt. Always her magical infinitude forces to aspire the inert brute elements. As one who has all infinity to waste, she scatters the seed of the eternal strength on a half-animate and crumbling mold, plants heaven's delight in the heart's passionate mire, pours Godhead's seekings into a bare beast frame, hides immortality in a mask of death. Once more, that will put on an earthly shape. Namaste. Jai Ma.